Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, May 6th, 2014. The UN Secretary General insists both sides agree to a peaceful solution to the crisis after meeting with President Kiir in Juba.
I urge the country's political leaders to put aside their grievances and end the bloodshed immediately. My message for both leaders is simple and clear, that both leaders should work together for peace.
And Sudanese bishop calls on President Omar al-Bashir to stop killing his own people.
Those who are angry, they run away. It's like the children who are not satisfied with the behavior of their father. If you are a father, call your children instead of shooting them.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon paid a one-day visit to Juba today to urge the warring sides to move quickly to restore peace in the country. As Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba, the Secretary General met with President Salva Kiir and spoke on phone to rebel leader and former Vice President Riek Machar to urge the two to hold direct talks and end the fighting.
I urge the country's political leaders to put aside their grievances and end the bloodshed immediately. My message for both leaders is simple and clear, that both leaders should work together for peace.
Ban Ki-moon called the ongoing conflict senseless and urged both President Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar to feel a sense of political responsibility for the destruction caused by the five-month-old conflict.
The fighting must end. Much damage has already been done. It may take long to heal. The country's leaders must close the wounds they have opened. They must support justice and accountability for crimes committed. And they must act to address the root causes of the conflict. That will take courage and wisdom and statesmanship.
Earlier in the day, the top UN official visited IDPs at a UN camp in Juba. He said he was heartbroken and saddened by what he saw, adding that people should not have to live in such conditions, fearing for their lives. Last week, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry also urged Mr. Kiir and Machar to hold face-to-face talks in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa to ensure that the two sides adhere to a cessation of hostilities agreement they signed in late January. So far, they have not. There have been numerous deadly attacks committed by both sides over the past 3 months. Ban says during his meeting with Mr. Kiir today, the president expressed his willingness to meet with Machar at the peace talks in Addis Ababa, possibly as early as Friday.
In that regard, I am encouraged that President Salva Kiir today announced publicly while standing at my side that he will meet with Dr. Machar soon in Addis Ababa. And in fact, I have strongly encouraged him to do that.
Ban confirmed he spoke to Machar by phone and expressed his hope that the former vice president would travel to Addis Ababa soon.
I explained my position that it is incumbent upon two leaders to sit down together and meet together and address this crisis through dialogue in a peaceful way. He said that he has been invited by Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Haile Mariam Desalegn, in his capacity as chair of IGAD, to come to Addis Ababa. He responded positively that he will be in Addis Ababa for the meeting in time, but he said he will try his best because he's now in a very remote area.
He says he expects Prime Minister Desalegn to facilitate talks between the two leaders. Ban says he supports the deployment of an African Union force from IGAD member countries to help end the fighting in South Sudan something the UN Security Council must also approve. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
As we heard, in his meeting with UN Secretary General, President Salva Kiir recommitted to meeting opposition leader Riek Machar in Addis Ababa. Philip Aleu has more for VOA from Juba.
Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesperson Mawiene Makol Arig says President Kiir used Ban Ki-moon's visit as an opportunity to send a clear message to the international community about the government's close relationship with the United Nations and to reassess its commitment to peace.
You know there has been misquotations, misunderstanding between the government and the army in South Sudan. And so he's busy actually with he himself to come and see the relations and the efforts that the government is trying to do to bridge the gap between the UN and the government of South Sudan, because they are here with that mission of the government of South Sudan. And so we have to, it is the duty of the government of South Sudan to respect their stay in South Sudan. And so all these allegations, all these talks are meaningless as far as the government is concerned, because we are supporting the UN, because they are helping people of South Sudan.
Tension had been building between the UN and South Sudan after a UN convoy was recently stopped and pound to be carrying weapons, a violation of the UN's own protocol. UN officials said it was a mistake, but shortly thereafter, the government stepped up checkpoints by security personnel, making it difficult for UN convoys to reach remote locations with much-needed food and medical supplies. Arik insists that Ban visits today shows the world that the UN mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, is welcome here. After the convoy incident, anti-UN marches were held in the streets of Juba. President Kiir even accused UNMISS of trying to establish a parallel government before publicly backing away from those comments. Arik says they see Ban's visit as a show of solidarity between the government and UN. He says it was particularly good timing, coming the day after the government and the opposition signed a one-month truce, allowing humanitarian organizations to reach people trapped in conflict zones.
The government is much more concerned with the suffering of the people of South Sudan. And so government is very excited, and the government is looking forward to see another commitment between the two parties, so which will help the people of South Sudan more.
The one-month agreement is set to take effect tomorrow. For BOA News, I am Philip Aleu in Juba.
Delegates at the peace talks in Addis Ababa have not agreed on the agenda for discussion to get at the root cause of the political crisis in South Sudan. Spokesman for the rebel delegation, Hussein Marnyot, says his group accepts the proposal of the mediators and is ready to talk.
So what IGAD did is actually to summarize the two agenda and put them in one paper, that this is, should be the middle ground agenda that actually we can discuss. They consulted us and we accepted in writing that we are for this agenda, although it does not actually express 100% of all what we need. But at least it's something we can live with. We can actually discuss all this.
The proposed agenda, handed to the groups by the Intergovernmental Authority for Development, or IGAD, includes interim government, its size, permanent constitution, and National Assembly, among others. Nyot says government delegates are reluctant to start negotiation on those issues.
We were actually informed that with the visit of the Secretary of the State, John Kerry, to Juba, that President Kiir agreed on this agenda. Now here, the delegation is completely refusing it and rejecting it totally. They said they will never commit themselves to discuss this. So now we left it for the mediators to work out something, and we'll see what will happen.
Marnyot says the SPLA in opposition is committed to finding a lasting solution to the political crisis in South Sudan. He confirms reports that Riek Machar is scheduled to meet with President Kiir very soon.
We received an official invitation to Dr. Machar to come to Addis. He will meet, of course, the government here, the Prime Minister, and senior people of the government of Federal Republic of Ethiopia. And then he will do some diplomatic work. After meeting these people, maybe they will schedule when are they meeting. Then President Kiir can come down here to Addis Ababa, and then they can meet. We are not actually very certain of the date.
That's Hussein Marnyot, the spokesman of the rebel SPLM in opposition. He was speaking to South Sudan in Focus yesterday from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. We were unable to reach Michael Makui, the spokesman for the South Sudan government delegation, for comment. The Catholic Church officials in Sudan are accusing Sudanese Air Force of bombing the only functioning hospital in southern Kordofan state last week. They say one person was injured and most people are now afraid to seek treatment at the hospital. Lucy Pony has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
Emeritus Bishop Makram Max Gesis spoke to reporters in Nairobi today to condemn the bombings. He says the Mother of Mercy Catholic Hospital treats some 150,000 people from the Nuba Mountains each year.
The bombing is an outrage against innocent civilians who are seeking medical assistance from our hospital. The sick have nothing to do with the conflict that has devastated the Nuba Mountains since June 2011. They are innocent civilians protected by international law from direct targeting by military forces.
Bishop Gesis says 11 bombs were dropped over a two-day period, two of which landed within the compound's walls. Fortunately, no one was killed, but Gesis says the hospital sustained serious damage, including shattered windows and doors. He says the roof of the doctor's house was completely destroyed. The Sudanese government has not publicly responded to the allegations by the Catholic Church in Sudan. Gesis says even if the Sudan Air Force was not responsible, which he doubts, Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir must take steps to protect the patients and staff at the hospital. Aerial bombardments devastated the Nuba Mountain region since 2011. Some groups living in the area have pushed for a referendum to determine whether they will remain part of Sudan. Gesis says many people living in the region feel they have no political or civil rights. He says the government and armed militias in the region must meet face to face and work out a solution.
There is no other way except to understand that carrying this gun is taking them nowhere. I consider Khartoum as a father, as they call, if they call themselves government. Those who are angry and they run away, it's like the children who are not satisfied with the behavior of the father. If you are a father, call your children instead of shooting them.
The United Nations says more than 200,000 people have fled the Nuba Mountains region over the last 3 years due to the frequent aerial bombardments carried out by the Sudanese government. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Nairobi.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Good personal hygiene is important to protect you, your family, and your community. More than 5,000 children die every day from diarrhea and stomach disorders caused by the bacteria found in human waste. People get sick when these bacteria are spread from person to person on their hands or clothing. But there are things you can do to help stop the spread of infection. Try to relieve yourself far away from where you cook, eat, and store food. Wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water after using the latrine. And keep cuts and scrapes clean and covered until they're healed. It is important to you and your family to understand the threat of diseases that can be spread by human waste and avoid them by staying clean.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the latest on the kidnapped schoolgirls in Nigeria. Stay tuned.
You don't want to miss VOA's South Sudan in Focus. You can hear us on one of our FM affiliate stations around the country or on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan. In Juba, listen to South Sudan in Focus at 8 p.m. on 93.5. You can also find us on shortwave at 11995, 13870, and 15180 kilohertz. Or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you believe that religion should play a role in politics?
Seriously, religion can play some roles. although not all in politics, but in some aspect it should play something. Yeah, I think religion is useful in politics sometimes.
No, I don't think so. When you involve religion into politics, you know, there's a tendency that the people might not be able to choose their leader.
Religious leaders will take that opportunity. They will not fear anything. They will say, even if I die, I will die for the word of God.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are discussing efforts to eliminate polio. The World Health Organization has declared the spread of polio an international public health emergency. WHO is imposing travel restrictions on countries infected with polio to stop the virus from spreading around the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Polio is endemic in three countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria. But this crippling disease recently has reemerged in seven countries in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, which had been polio-free. They are Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Ethiopia, Iraq, Israel, Somalia, and Syria. A WHO emergency committee considers the international spread of polio this year to be an extraordinary event. It warns the exportation of the wild virus poses a public health risk and must be stopped urgently. WHO Assistant Director General Bruce Aylward says the situation is particularly serious because the new polio infections have occurred between January and April, which is the low transmission season for the disease.
The committee highlighted to the Director General that if the situation as of today and April 2014 went unchecked, it could result in failure to eradicate globally one of the world's most serious vaccine-preventable diseases.
When WHO began its global polio eradication campaign in 1988, there were 350,000 cases of polio. Last year, there were 417 cases. So far this year, WHO reports 74 new cases, including 59 from Pakistan alone. Dr. Aylward cites Pakistan, Cameroon, and Syria as posing the greatest risk of further wild polio virus exportations in 2014. To prevent this from happening, the committee has come up with a series of recommendations. These include a demand that all residents and long-term visitors in affected countries get immunized against polio, either with an oral or inactivated poliovirus vaccine. This should be done between 4 weeks and 12 months prior to international travel. It also advises people traveling abroad from these countries to carry a certificate to prove they have been vaccinated against polio. Dr. Aylward says a coordinated international response is essential to stop the international spread of this crippling disease and to prevent more cases from emerging during the high transmission season in May and June.
The committee also highlighted that the consequences of further international spread are particularly acute today, given the large number of polio-free but conflict-torn and fragile states which have severely compromised routine immunization services and are at particularly high risk of infection. It highlighted as well that these states would have extreme difficulty in mounting an effective response should they become reinfected.
A case in point is Syria, which was polio-free for 14 years and has become reinfected from Pakistan. Aid agencies have mounted polio immunization campaigns inside this war-torn country with difficulty. However, they regularly immunize refugee children against the disease once they cross borders into neighboring countries. The WHO committee will reconvene in 3 months to reassess the situation. If their recommendations are not having the desired effect, health officials say there are other, more stringent measures that can be taken to try to stop the further spread of the polio virus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we move to Nigeria. Islamist militants have threatened to sell more than 250 girls who were kidnapped from their school in northern Nigeria last month. But Nigerian officials say, despite the growing public outrage over the abduction, the World Economic Forum for Africa will open tomorrow as planned. As Heather Murdock reports for VOA from Abuja, President Goodluck Jonathan says, quote, "Terror will not stop us from work."
Shouting on this video is a man that appears to be Abubakar Shekau, the man who says he leads Islamist insurgents known as Boko Haram.
Peace of Allah.
He carries a machine gun and is flanked by masked men in fatigues. In his typical maniacal fashion, he threatens to sell off the nearly 300 girls he says his group kidnapped last month, calling them his slaves. No girls appear on the video. But activists and families say the girls remain missing, and parents across Nigeria are increasingly angry. Some analysts say the video released Monday may have been timed to coincide with the World Economic Forum for Africa, an international conference that starts Wednesday and will draw more than 1,000 delegates, including many heads of state. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says Boko Haram activities will not disrupt the forum.
Terror will not stop us from work. The act of terror in Africa is diversionary, being organized by a group of people that don't want the continent to move forward. Whenever any country is showing any sign of progress, you see these criminal elements that will come up to retard the country.
But critics blame the Nigerian government for failing to stop Boko Haram. The militants have been blamed for thousands of deaths in the past 5 years. Two bombings within the past month at a bus station near the capital, Abuja, killed nearly 100 people. Boko Haram says it wants to install its harsh version of Islamic law, but Clement Nwankwo, who directs the Policy and Legal Advocacy Center in Abuja, says the violence may be partially driven by politics.
For us who are asking questions, we're asking, did somebody set up this bomb in order to blame the opposition for it? In which case, perhaps it's not even Boko Haram. So these are questions that our Nigerians are asking.
As world leaders arrive in Abuja for the Economic Forum, authorities are tightening security, preparing to virtually shut down the city for the conference. The World Economic Forum says there are security concerns, but cancellations for the event were no more than usual. Heather Murdock for VOA News, Abuja.
In South Africa, the campaign for legislative and provincial elections are winding down, with voters heading to polls tomorrow. More than two dozen parties are on the ballot. However, analysts believe the ruling African National Congress will retain an overwhelming majority, with the main opposition Democratic Alliance increasing its share of the vote. VOA's William Eagle reports.
For months, opinion polls had shown lagging public confidence in the ANC. The drop is blamed in part on the expenditure of millions of tax dollars and lavish improvements of the presidential complex at Nkandla. Public opinion also reflected disapproval of the violent police response to striking miners in Marikana 2 years ago. But a recent poll by the research company Ipsos showed that 65% of voters still intend to vote for the ANC, at least on the national level. Yaki Siliers is the director of the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria. He says South Africans still vote on party loyalty rather than policy.
You must remember the ANC is more than 100 years old. It's got an unparalleled brand. And there are two stories about South Africa. The one story is, the story of Nkandla, corruption, and so on. The other story is really, if you look quite carefully at what the ANC has been able to deliver, it has been access to electricity, social grants, infrastructure in rural areas. These things are not that visible. to many South Africans. But I've just spent the last 2 days driving from East London in the Eastern Cape through to Durban. And you can see the extent of impact that the ANC has made in rural areas. So it's important to recognize that while the ANC, particularly in the urban areas, is struggling, in rural areas, not only does it have its liberation credentials and does it dominate the political life and the fourth, it is also done quite well for ordinary Africans.
Others attribute the successful patronage systems built by parties with origins as liberation movements. Hussein Solomon is a professor of political studies at the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein, South Africa.
The ANC has been very smart, conflating state and party, government and party, in that they've been handing out, you know, food parcels, putting up buildings, and so on, and claiming this is the ANC government is doing this way, putting up concerts for the youth. So, you know, don't worry about all of our failures for the next 2 hours. You're going to have food and you're going to have great music. And unfortunately, to be frank, the voters tend to be quite fickle and they have a short memory. So I think that the ANC has been quite smart in terms of this.
The elections may also help boost the main opposition, the Democratic Alliance. Some polls of registered voters say the party could increase its share of the vote from roughly 17% to 23%. Sillier says there are some factors working in the DA's favor. He says urban dissatisfaction may lead some voters to split their vote for the provincial and national leadership.
Gauteng is going to be a very close race, according to all the recent polls, between the ANC and the Democratic Alliance. And to complicate matters further, the ANC leadership of Gauteng, which is the richest province, I think about half of the GDP of South Africa comes from there, is a person called Paul Mashatile. He was actually opposed to Zuma's candidacy as president of the ANC and was actually campaigning against him. So there's all kinds of tensions inside the ANC there. They might well lose to the DA if we factor in the economic freedom fighters, meaning that young unemployed youth will essentially vote against the ANC.
Some analysts say if the ANC does poll much below its current 66% of voters at the national level, the party could vote to replace President Zuma. Others do not think that's likely, and they think there will be pressure on the ANC to reform. That could mean moving to the left on issues such as land reform or nationalization of parts of the economy. Yaki Sillier says it could also mean a split within the ANC.
And many of us hope that Cyril Ramaphosa will, when appointed, because I think it is a question of when appointed deputy president, will be given sufficient autonomy, power within the Zuma administration to be able to focus our policies going forward on the implementation of the National Development Plan. If that happens, and the ANC may just be in an easier position to do that, given that it has lost some of the constraining influence on the left, in other words, NUMSA and others, to be able to do that, it may be quite a good news development for South Africa going forward.
Sillier does not think this election is a turning point. It's hard to beat the ANC brand, he says. But future polls, including municipal elections, will be another opportunity for opposition parties to expand their influence. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
That report brings us to the end of our show for tonight. We now leave you with the song Dudu by US-based South Sudanese musician Sultan Clinton. Shut up. We have been listening to Sultan Clinton with the song Dudu. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening and remember to join us again tomorrow for more news on South Sudan in Focus. from the Voice of America.